Okay, I think we'll make a start. Boker Tov. I love this period in Israel because there's two time frames in Israel: Lifnei Chagim and Acharei Achar Chagim. Before the Chagim and after the Chagim. Before the Chagim, nothing happens till after the Chagim, as you all know. And we're now, thank God, in the after the Chagim period. So I was reminded of it because we're talking a bit about war, which is not an easy subject to talk about. I got to say. This is one of the A to Z topics we never got to, and I wanted to do it because it's just so important, because it's so much part of, the sort of the reality of life, particularly in Israel. And to me, it's about what Israel is all about, because there's no question. I think back to my sukkah decorations. You all have the experience of having that poster which lasted for about 20 years. Eventually, just got so, gringy or grungy and whatever, you had to put it away. And the one that I love, which we had in our sukkah in London for years, was the soldier sitting on top of a tank, sort of benching Lord of an Esra. That was during the Yom Kippur War, which was over Sukkot. And that to me, it's like the picture you come in here. If you look in the mural downstairs, this beautiful mural, when you come into the school, of the soldier, two soldiers side by side, one in the uniform and the other one, Talis and Twin, and they're both davening at the Kotel. And that is so much what Israel is about. As you'll see, in essence, this is the ultimate expression of what I always felt when living in Israel, as we did for a number of years, why Israel can really be called a Jewish country. Many people argue it's a country for the Jews, but not really Jewish, because, Chil Shabbat and all the things that, unfortunately, people start complaining about. But the reality is, it is a very Jewish country. And the ethics of war are just so embedded in the country. I'll give you one example. I did basic training in Israel when I was living there. And the first Shabbat, this was before Intifada number 1, so it's quite a long time ago. And we were on what is called in Hebrew, Konanut. We were ready to go in to stop a riot, right? What did I know about stopping a riot? Nothing, but, you're part of the group. And it was interesting because it was near Shechem. We were on a basis, army base, not far from Shechem. And the order came that for this Shabbat, if any trouble starts up in Shechem, we were one of the first groups to go in and break it all up. Thank you very much. I wasn't very excited about that. On the other hand, it's what you got to do, what you got to do. But the whole Shabbos, I'm not exaggerating, this was a group of soldiers. In those days, used to have something called Shlav Bet, right? What I used to call Hogan's Heroes, because that's essentially what we were, if you know the program. We sort of fetched our way through becoming soldiers, but it's all part of the experience in Israel. I'm really glad I did it. The whole Shabbos, religious, secular, we had a Braz lover, we had a Chabad, we had a guy who was so vehemently anti-religious. I mean, it was quite shocking to me, but again, kind of respectful, interest. He put out his cigarette before I came into the tent. He saw the religious guy in the tent, so he respected that. Now, that to me was very interesting. And we spent the whole Shabbos discussing the morality of what we've been asked to do. We literally debated it, and, should we do this, should we not? It's become such a, a given that the Israeli army runs at a level of morality which is way above anything else that you'll find in the world. And, I don't make any apologetics for that. I think that in a way it does harm Israel. That sometimes we're just too much into the Russian tosis when we get an order, And as I mentioned here, there's a horrible story, something that happened in Jenin, one of the Arab towns, a couple of years ago, when the soldiers were being told very, very categorically to do house-to-house searches when they could have initially bombed the place, and they didn't, and they lost a lot of soldiers. A lot of the soldiers were killed. And the reality of it is that the Jewishness of Israel is really reflected in many, many ways, but in this area in particular. And as you go through, you'll see the sort of things that we're going to talk about, how they come together and how they're so significant in the mindset, in the neshama of the state of Israel today, the land of Israel. Yes.
So do you remember the general, Brigadier General
Ben C. Gruber? Gruber, I remember, yeah.
So he talked very much about the same thing.
Right, he's a religious guy, right? Was he Dati?
Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah, Masorati more.
Masorati, yeah.
But he wrote the thing on morality and the idea.
Right, and it's just...
Everything you're saying is
It's been so... to me, it's one of the greatest acts of Kiddush Hashem in the world, is what the IDF does. The sadness to me is how it gets distorted, either by the media, and we don't have to go into that unfortunate subject, or more by the propaganda which is put out. I know they're having problems in Colombia at the moment. You know, I was working there for many years and I saw it coming, but apparently it's getting a lot worse, and it's worrying. It's worrying that this distortion is being allowed to happen and not being counteracted by the truth. Reality is that, you know, there's so many things that are being said about the army. I just wish other armies in the world were remotely as worried about morality as certainly would be anywhere near what the Israeli army is doing. It would be a different world, but we know this. Look at the problem. The problem is interesting because we respect life. Life to us is sacrosanct, right? Sakanat nefashot. Pikuach nefesh docheh Shabbat. We know that life and death, you break the Sabbath. In fact, the halacha says that if you save a life on Shabbos by breaking Shabbos, you're actually kiddush. It's called kiddush Shabbat. You're sanctifying Shabbat by doing that. It's embedded in us, the importance of life, of preserving life. Anyone who saves one soul, as if you save the whole world, we know this. And yet, we're not pacifists. We're not a group of people who sit back and say that having an army is not for us. On the contrary, you know, we do have an army, and we've maintained, certainly in the modern day. My wife's cousin told me something very interesting. He said that when he joined the army, part of a group from Mecca Zarab, he said his Rebbe told him that you have to say Shechiyonu when you put on the uniform. And he asked the Rebbe, but the new one won't be new, it's recycled, you know, these are not new uniforms. He said, no, it's not about the uniform being new, it's about the fact you've got a Jewish army for the first time in 2,000 years, you say Shechiyonu. And that was really, that's a statement, fantastic statement. And again, all of these things that we have to have it is to us the biggest challenge. It's in the names of God. God has 70 names. So one name of God is Shalom, right? That's why some people are worried about saying Shalom in the bathroom. You shouldn't really say the word. Fine. But on the other hand, we know, we say it every day, Ish Milchama, Hashem Ish Milchama, name of God is man of war. So make up your mind, is God the man of peace, the man of war? There is this intrinsic kind of almost contradiction in the names of God, which expresses this dilemma. What should we be, men of war, men of peace? And going through the resources, this is what I want to really show you, because a lot of what I'm going to say, I guess, is relatively well known, but some of these sources are just beyond belief. Avraham Avinu. What is Avraham Avinu? The man of peace. His tent has got four sides, and you raise the doors, everything is open for anyone to come in. And yet, we're going to read, not next Shabbos, 2 weeks' time, his nephew gets into, as they say, a bit of bother, right? He's captured by whatever it is, four kings and five kings, whatever that is all about. And who becomes the soldier, you know, who's Captain America or Captain whatever you want to call him, goes to the rescue of Avraham Avinu, of all people, right? The man who sits there all day waiting for guests to come and can't do enough for of chesed, he's the guy who leads the battle. And the incredible thing, not only he leads it, but he wins it, right? He gets his nephew back, and they become very, the kings become very subservient to him. It's quite amazing. Please, just grab a cup of coffee, and then you've got... Okay. Alright, so again, the contradiction is reflected in Avraham Avinu, and Yaakov, the same thing. Number two, what happened with Esau? Famous thing which the Ramban brings here. Valdati, says the Ramban, this is number two on the first page, three quarters of the way down. Just read the Hebrew text, it's very short. Valdati Gamze Yirmoz, the whole story of Abraham, excuse me, of Yaakov and Esau, when Esau is rushing to attack Yaakov, and Yaakov prepares for war, he says, Ki anachu itchalnu nefilatenu biyad Edom, ki malchei bayit sheni bo bibrit im haromayim. He said, this is all a future reference to what's going to happen with the Hasmonean dynasty later on, and the whole discussion with the Romans, and how to make peace. Umehem shebo baroma, kakata rabbeinu, vehi aita sibat nefilatam biyadam, And basically the Ramban says that in this way, with the fact that we gave in, Yaakov in the end sort of makes peace with Esau, that reflects the future when the Hasmonean dynasty is going to make peace with the Romans, but of course it eventually leads to destruction of the Second Temple, as we know, and the whole history. What is so interesting is that in the Bible, all of these battles were not far from a battle in any parsha that we read, and we learn from the technical side of what went on, how to conduct battles in our day. This is one of the rules of learning the book of Bereshit. And I'll tell you a little story, because it's not in the book that I imagine most of you have read. A lot of people have read and been very excited about a book called The Prime Ministers by Yehuda Avner, Zichron Livrocha. He was the ambassador to London of the Israeli government, was in Washington for a number of years, and really was a very special man. And someone that my family, my wife's family, knew him from the Bachad days, from the days of Bnei Akiva, going back before, literally, Ashara, back in England in the late 40s. They were preparing for Aliyah. And once we met Yehuda Avner in London, and he told us the story just after Camp David. It was very fascinating. He said he was on the plane and with Menachem Begin. And he was Begin's he was advisor to all the prime ministers. He'd read the book, you know, he advised them all about Inyanei Chutz, the whole thing of things, diaspora matters, as they called it. And Begin gets up in the middle of the journey and makes an announcement. The prime minister's making an announcement, everybody listens. He said, "Has anyone got a chumash here?" Right? This is Nachum Begin. If you knew about him, it was kind of typical. He said, "Anyone brought a chumash with?" You know, he's looking around. So who's got the chumash? Yehuda Avner. As he was known, Gubi Avner, he had the chumash. He said, "Boyana," he said, "so come and sit next to the prime minister." For an hour, he said, they sat together learning Parshat Vayishla. Right? Begin put on his kippah. A cheder yinger, he studied in cheder. He knew the story, but he wanted to learn a little bit of the commentary and a bit of the background, because he'd had that tradition from the Haim. Begin knew that when you dealt with the non-Jewish world, where do you get your guidance from? The Torah. Unbelievable. And they said, Yehuda Avner said that for that hour they sat learning chumash, and it was like learning in yeshiva. It was unbelievable. On a plane flying to Camp David, unbelievable, remarkable. Don't think the story's in the book. And again, I'm waiting for part two to come out. If there's any, the family, I don't know if they're working on any manuscripts, because many more stories, but of interactions that Yehuda Avner had with these people is really fascinating. He was a very interesting guy. So again, learning from Jewish history, learning from the stories. We're going to be reading these stories in the next couple of weeks. If you just turn over to the second page, what do we learn from Yaakov Avinu? It's either on the back of the handout or separate page. I'm not sure. Some of them were double-sided. Three steps in conducting war. So we've already got a battle plan. Number one, appease the enemy. And this becomes a rule in Torah, as we'll see later on. Number two, pray for God's assistance. That's the mural downstairs, the idea of the soldier and the man standing side by side. They're both davening for Siyata Dishmaya, that God should help them. And then number three, if everything else fails, then you have to go to war. All right, as Winston put it so well, Georgia before war, right? Talk first, try and iron it out. But if you have to, then option number three is there. And in Jacob's case, of course, eventually the reconciliation happened, but he was prepared. He divided his camp into two groups. We know the story. We're going to read it again very, very soon. Yeah.
But we're told when it comes to the Sheva Umos that you're not allowed to be, you're not allowed to make treaties.
Well, you'll see, that's not absolutely true. And this is the next part of what we've got here from the Rambam. And it is fascinating. When you learn Sefer Yoshua, and you know that there's a rule which says, Lo t'chayek on the Shama. There's a rule in the Torah. When the Jews came into Eretz Israel, the negative influence was not to be there, and you had to essentially wipe out all the nations there. Yeshua did not do that, right? And everyone asked the question, why not? What happened? And for instance, Rachav, famous woman eventually marries, is saved, right? Where's the mitzvah of what the Torah seems to say of killing the enemy? The answer is, and this is really brought in the Rambam here, is that there are certain preambles to war which were done even in that circumstance. The first thing Yeshua did, I'm not sure if this is number page 2 or page 3. We're going to come to it. Peace must be offered. Here, look at the top of page 3. The Rambam brings this in Hilchot Melachim, right? The third page, and it really is not known. It says like this, it's Rambam, Hilchot Melachim, Vav Chet, chapter 6, section 8. Shlosha ketavim shalach Yoshua ad shlo nichnas la'aretz. He sent three letters. Three diplomatic approaches were made by Yoshua to the people living in Israel at the time. Harishon shalach lahem. The first letter said, Misha ratzeh livrach, yivrach. You want to run away? We'll give you permission. You don't have to fight. But we're coming. We're getting up. We're coming back. And then, v'chazar v'shalah, second letter said, Misha ratzeh lashlim, yashlim. You want to make peace? We'll make peace. We'll work it out. So there wasn't going to be a total destruction happening at that time. And then, v'chazar v'shalah, one assumes that the response to these letters was minimal, so he sent a third letter, Misha ratzeh lasot milchama, yaseh. Anyone who wants to make war, we're going to make war. But the reality is, says the Rambam, im kei, bibnei mahir, and then, so the Rambam's got a whole discussion, which is a specific story in Sefer Yoshua, about a group of people who tried to trick Yoshua to believe that they weren't part of the Kana'anim. They were known as the Givonim, Gibeonites. Chapter 9 of Sefer Yoshua. And the reality was that they made a trick and Yoshua made a promise not to harm them. It's a whole parsha by itself, but the reality is that they should have sent back a response to letter number 1 or letter number 2 to say to Yoshua, we want to make peace. And it would have been accepted. There's no such thing as an absolute commandment at that time to destroy the enemy. The commandment was, go through the process, almost like the process that was set up by Yaakov Avinu. Firstly, you go and try and appease. Then you're davening. Obviously, tefillah is very, very important. And it was also an extra item here of allowing the people to leave. If they could run away, you give them the ability to do so. And finally, everything else fails, then you go to war. And if you learn the story of Yoshua, I'm just teaching this at college, it's fascinating that although they went round the city once for 6 days, and then 7 days, seven times, like we do on Sukkot, right? That's one of the reasons why we do it on Sukkot, to remind us of that story. The reality was that when they faced the city of Jericho, right? The Jews were only standing at the front of the city. When the walls came down, it wasn't the walls of all the city. If you look very closely, you'll see that Rachav, the woman who was saved, lived in the walls of the city. If the walls came down, she would have been killed, but she wasn't. So the reality, say the rabbis, is that imagine a square town that you're coming into with walls around it. The wall facing just disappeared into the ground. And the Jews marched in over, no rubble, it was completely smooth out. That's the way, and you look at the verses, it comes out like that. Why is that significant? Because it means that the other side of the city, presumably there were gates at the back of the city, they could run away. You give the enemy the option of running away. You're not looking to kill them outright. You're giving them certain options. If they want to stand and fight you, you've got to defend yourself. You've got to do what you've got to do. But the reality of it is, you don't go into a situation with guns blazing and, you know, all the tactics of war that we understand. There is a lot more of conciliation or trying to get people to come together. And look what's going on. I mean, you know, peace process is now, I don't know, I don't think in Israel they believe it's ever going to happen, but we've been living with that concept for years and years and years.
It reminds me of the leaflets that our Israeli army drops down, you know.
Which army in the world does that? And made cell phone calls, you know, to the enemy. Get out. We're going to bomb this building in 20 minutes. Get out of there. And it's beyond belief. Yeah. It's beyond belief. And even within the war, there are levels of the way that they go about it, which is just not known. People don't know this. And it's so important to get that message out there of even how the wars are fought and how the Israeli army is held to such a high level of credibility, well, it's essentially of morality. They're expected to behave in a very moral way. It's fascinating because there is my favorite law of war, which is about the fruit trees. In the middle of the laws dealing with war, You get a whole discussion about fruit trees. Yeah. Thank you very much. You know, the last thing I think I would worry about in the middle of a battle is about the fruit tree, which is standing in the middle of the field. But say the rabbis, no, that is part of our approach. Our approach is that when a battle takes place, we have to worry about Jewish values, even when it comes to the environment, whatever you want to call it, ecology. You know, we're worried about fruit tree. We don't destroy them. Certainly not in a siege. We have a mitzvah which becomes very, very interesting. Many shilas, you'd be amazed how many shuls have asked questions over the years about the parking lot where there's a fruit tree. Can they uproot the fruit tree to build a parking lot? Alright, these are questions that come really almost on a daily basis around the world because shuls are being built, thank God, but they have these challenges. And the halakha about uprooting a fruit tree is very, very strict. Amazing. So, in the middle of war, this is what we're worried about. I love the Devar Torah, and I'll just share it with you because it's a very simple one. That the end of Parshat Shoftim, which is all about war, it talks about this whole thing of fruit trees and preparing for war and whatever. And the beginning of Parshat Ki Tetzeh is also talking about capturing this woman in battle, etc. In the middle, between the two subjects, there is a whole discussion of what is called Egla Rufa. What's Egla Rufa? They find a dead body, Nebuch, somewhere between two cities. Not war, just happened. And the city nearest has to come to that place, and they do a whole ceremony as it, to be responsible for the death of the person, because they didn't give the person the correct welcome when he came into the city, etc. What's that got to do with war? It's in between two sections dealing with war. Say the rabbis, you know what? It's all about war. Because in war, the greatest concern is the individual person. We are worried about the individuality of that person to preserve almost the dignity, as they say, to preserve the life as best we can. And that is the message from the Torah, direct. In a situation where two parshiot are talking about war in the middle, we worry about the corpse, we don't even know who it is. Because we worry about the person, we worry about the human life, human dignity, what we can do for this person, or what we can do at least to respect the person after he's found to be dead. All of that is part of the morality of the army, at the ideal Jewish army, and I would say very much the army today as well. The number of times, the shocking thing, preparing this brought back a lot of memories. We did a basic training, and this was again, as I said, before the Intifada, but it was around the Lebanon War in 1982. And we got a talk from one of the generals. He came along, and he said, Rabotai, he said, who is the greatest enemy that you're facing? So we explained, I don't know, that time Hezbollah, whatever it was, I don't think they were around yet, it was whatever it was, it's just reinvention of the same evil. And, you know, we were talking, and he says, no. He says, your greatest enemy is a 10-year-old child. So he said, Ma pitom. He says, that 10-year-old kid, when you meet him, and you're walking through a town in Lebanon, and you want to give him a candy, he's got a bomb in his hand, and he is going to kill you. He says, you've got to overcome a natural instinct in a way that you can't imagine. That was his advice, and he was right. Because the number of times that this has happened, when unfortunately we know that children are used in this way, in certainly in Gaza and places like that, all these demonstrations, they take children to the front lines. I mean, this is an enemy that is so, so difficult to deal with, in not just in the practicalities, but in the moral sense as well. It's very, very difficult. And as I said, a lot of memories have sort of came back. As I said, a bit of Hogan's Heroes as well. I actually learned the Hebrew for push-up in the army. Because the guy, the first night, we didn't know what he wanted us to do. And so we started making a bit of chosik of the officers. So he said 20 push-ups. Nobody knew what the Hebrew for push-up was, so we didn't know what he wanted us to do. So he demonstrated. By the time he demonstrated, he was so tired, he just gave up on us. He said, Gehavek, you know, he said in Yiddish, because he thought, well, at least I'll understand Yiddish. It's unforgettable. You know, there's things about the Jewishness of the army. It's beyond belief. It's remarkable. The war stops for mincha, you should know. The Israeli army absolutely stops for mincha. You've got time in the morning, designated for davening, mincha, maariv. You got to be tough and stick to those times, especially if you're not with a religious group. But the army, by order, has to respect that particular situation.
So
that's
my
really
math
important.
Classes in Brooklyn College.
Sorry?
So did my math classes.
Lahavdil, yeah, that's cute, I mean, but for different reasons.
Profound things in the army is that, you know, when you go to the tekes of your children or whoever is your watching, that they're given a Tanakh.
Tanakh and a gun.
And they're told Yehoshua's words.
Correct. Chazak ve'ematz, yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah,
that, well, depends on which group it is.
Again, why do we had it on the army base. We went through the tekes, and the only problem was it was Hanukkah time, so they wanted to do a bit of marching, because there was some bigwig coming to give us this Tanakh, and they wanted to teach us how to march. Now, most countries in the world, you know, the American army, you know the tunes. In Israel, what tunes do you march to? Hanukkah tunes. It was like marching to Boaz too. It's the strangest thing. Strange experience. But that's all we knew. So, you know, it was funny. It was really, there's a lot of stories which, as I said, they came back to me when I started looking
How
at this
long
stuff.
Were you in the army?
I did basic training. I did Miluim. My unit doesn't exist anymore because it was called Kavanim, where they used to lay cables. It was quite dangerous because we were the first ones there to lay the cables to get everybody in touch with everybody, you know. Now it's all done by cell phone, but we were the last ones out. And that was always the worst part of it. You know, they left you behind almost to the point because you had to schlep all the cables out. It was an experience, no question about it. I don't know. That's another, maybe a discussion for another time. Sensitivity to human life. Let's just look at the bottom of the page here. Back to page 2. All from Rambam. As I said, you don't surround the city on four sides. If you attack a city, the maximum is three sides. Bottom, this is the bottom of the page. And you have to leave a direction for them to run away. Whoever wants to escape. Right? That's very not the way wars are usually conducted. Midian, and it's a pasuk from the story of the fight with Midian. What did God command Moshe to allow the Midianites to escape if it comes to that situation when they want to run away? Another famous thing, Hallel on Pesach. Right? For some reason, what do? We do this thing called Chatzi Hallel. Okay, for mathematicians, it doesn't work. It's not chatzi halal. It's not half the halal. It's just missing two paragraphs out of 15 paragraphs. But it's known traditionally as chatzi or chetzi. And the question is, what is it all about? So the tradition is because after the Jews came out of Egypt and at the end of that period of the week of Pesach, they crossed the Red Sea and the Egyptians were drowning. And the Midrash puts it so beautifully. It says that the angels went to God and complained, you know, about the fact that the Jews are being saved. Surely they're idolatrous as well. And there's a whole discussion between God and the angels. And one of the things that comes out of that discussion is the fact that God is saying to the Jewish people, you can't sing halal at this point because my creatures are dying. Right? The Egyptians. Now, they're not the most favorite people in the world as far as the Jews were concerned, but they are in the image of God. And the dipping of the wine with, you know, whether how you do it, tip the cup or whatever, all of it, all the symbolism. But it's so powerful because it's saying that in war you've got to recognize that the person you're standing up against is, in the end of the day, but Selem Elokim. Right? How much of an image of God that person reflects in their own behavior, that's a discussion for itself. But as far as we're concerned, this is a creation of God. And it goes on and it goes on. And it's just fascinating how all of this, as I said at the beginning, is intrinsic, is so much part of who we are as Jews in terms of our existence, certainly today in Israel, that we incorporate so much of this morality into everything we do in terms of army, in terms of what goes on in the Tzahal today. It's fascinating. Look at these, page 3, the types of war, because we have two types of war which are defined by the Torah. The majority of cases know Muhammad Mitzvah. Muhammad Mitzvah is this idea of obligatory war. I'm sorry I didn't keep it. I had a cutout from the Hatzofer, used to be the Mizrahi newspaper. It died about 25 years ago. They put out a daily paper, Mizrahi. And it was a notice from the Rabbanut HaRashid, again, 1982, I kept the cutout, of telling everybody that this war Yom Kippur for sure, and the Six-Day War for sure, but 1982, the incursion into Lebanon was also defined by the rabbinate as Milchemet Mitzvah. There is no one who should argue that because this is maybe not on the same level, seemingly, as the previous wars, it's not a Milchemet Mitzvah. It is. It's a Milchama, a war, which is based on the principle of a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah to go, says the Gemara about it, that even Chatan Mechupato, God forbid it should happen, but even a Chatan leaving the Chuppah. I still have those images of 1973, the men being called out of shul, still wearing their talitot, they're wearing the talesim, and they're being pushed into the army vans, being taken to the army bases because the attack had begun on Yom Kippur. It's an unforgettable image. And this again is really what we're saying. Muhammad Mitzvah, everyone has an obligation. It says that the Torah is not comfortable with the idea of women in the army, and that's become a very big debating point ever since the whole thing of Giyus Banot, 1950s, and the discussion, bless you, between different rabbis as to what to do. Many girls today, I'm glad to say, not necessarily frontline army soldier, that happens as well, but more in terms of educational arm of the army. That's a really, really interesting thing. A lot of girls who don't want to necessarily spend their Shnat Sheirut doing voluntary service, want to go to the army, but they can do something which is so, so important. The army is one of the biggest educational bodies in Israel today. Many people come out of school and they still need those 3 years, not just learning how to be a soldier, but also learning how to be a mensch. And it really is important. I think, and that's still true to this very day.
My son was in combat engineering, so they were learning a lot about explosives and tunnels. A lot of their teachers were women in the army.
And that's and of course, why then is it the startup nation? Because from the army, they learn all these fantastic skills, and they start companies. And the next thing you know, the whole country has become famous for this. It's where everyone goes to get all the know-how about technology and about weapons and about everything else, because Israel is doing it. Israel doesn't just do it, doesn't just talk about it, but Israel does it. And it's beyond belief.
Also, when you go into a museum like Yad Vashem and you see Army Group, they're led by a woman
teacher
who's teaching them about the places. That
correct.
As if they're hearing it for the first time.
And it's and for many, it really is.
That's another thing. All the Army Groups go to Jerusalem for a week just for a historical
correct.
Tour.
It
so they have a reason.
And it gives them the basis, the real reason of what it's about. It's so embedded. It's embedded in everything to do with the army. And in my yeshiva, for instance, I was with a group of Hester boys. And Hester is something which is really, really extraordinary. It's a scheme started in 1961 in Keren Biavna. My Rosh Hashiva was the first group of Hester boys that went. And for those who don't know, it's a 5-year commitment, but it's 3 years in the army and 2 years yeshiva. You go for 1 year to the army and then 1 year to the yeshiva, and you keep switching, but you're with a group. You're with a very strong group of friends, and to this day, it's really something. It's really, really something. I think there's even now an American yeshiva, Leiv HaTorah, I think in Beit Shemesh, that's got the permission to have a Hester program within an American yeshiva. That was a real breakthrough, because it was only really considered fit for the Israeli yeshiva, but this is essentially an American program, but a lot of boys want to begin that process by being in Hester, and then presumably make Aliyah afterwards. The second type of category of wars, as you see what I said, Milchemet Mitzvah, for instance, conquering Eretz Yisrael, the war against Amalek, if you look at page 4, the whole thing about Amalek today, there's a very famous comment of the Rav Soloveitchik about this, which I'm not going to go into, that's really for another time. The third category, a defensive war, right? Israel is threatened, and you can't get more defensive wars than the Six-Day War, the Yom Kippur War, everything about those wars, the War of Independence, this was all about defending our position, our existence in the land of Israel. And particularly, I remember the beginning of the Six-Day War, how, the media was so distorted on day one and made out as if Israel had gone. Firstly, it said Israel army had been routed, the Israeli Air Force had been destroyed, when of course it was really the other way around. And the whole presentation of the war at the beginning was just completely back to front. And the reality was that even if Israel had to make a preemptive strike, which I think they did at the beginning, the threat was so intense. So many people were talking, God forbid, about another Holocaust, that there's no way that situation could continue. A lot of stuff, really, for those who haven't read about it, don't remember it, there's a lot of reading to be done because it's fascinating. Interesting. What happens if the non-Jew just threatens you that he's going to come and attack you? Can you stand up and defend yourself? Says the Mishnah Berurah. It's an interesting thing. And this is the middle of the fourth page. Shulchan Aruch. Look at what the Mishnah Berurah says. Mishnah Berurah, Rechov Yitz Chaim, died in 1933, before the State of Israel. But he says, Afilo lo bo, it's the second Hebrew paragraph on page 4. Rotza lo ma, kasha kol yotze, shirotzim lavo, you hear that the enemy is coming. Even if they're not there yet, you can already put on weapons, lishma velaso, kol ba'ir, to guard the city and make an announcement, kedei shelo yavo, that the enemy should not come, the aim adak the kim bekuach nefesh. And this was one of the incredible things in Meir Shearim in 1948, but I saw the pictures of particularly the Hasidic Gur. Gerach Hasidim have been very, very pro-Israel all the way through. All of the anti-Zionist stuff does not come from the Gerers. The Gerers are the guys with the fur hats spodic. That go up, the cylinder, the spodics, as opposed to the Satmaras. They've got a different approach, the Shrimals. And the Gerers, there are pictures of them in 48 digging trenches on Shabbat. I think Yehuda Avner even mentions it in his book, that he talks about the yeshiva boys being told that, you know, by the Rosh Hashiva, this is what you do now. They wanted to sit and learn. They said, learning is important. Yes, but also we need to dig trenches. We need to sandbags and all the rest of it. And they were doing this right through the beginning of the War of Independence. It's again, things that we should know about. The second type of war, Mohammed Rashut, is really not as common today. It was something that really applied at the time of King David. King David made a policy that he was going to make a buffer zone around Israel. Not a bad idea. So what he decided to do, he conquered half of Syria. Today, the United Nations will have something to say about that. But reality of it is, he went right up to Damascus, and so you draw a line from Damascus right across. That seems to be the area that David conquered. And his attitude was very simply, you keep the enemy further away from the borderline of Israel, which is, you know, sort of Metula and the Hermon. You keep them a long way away, we'll have less attacks, less problems, and that was his attitude. But it was called Mechemet Rashut. And Mechemet Rashut means it was non-obligatory. So there, the laws are slightly different. There, it's much more of a conscripted army as opposed to everyone chipping in. That nowadays, not the definition that usually applies. Who's exempt from fighting? This is my favorite thing. Listen to this, the bottom of the page, of page 4.
Was there actually ever an incident where...
In the Bible, in biblical terms, but not today, not today. Right? I don't think any of the wars, as I said, 1982, the Lebanon campaign that I have, that cut, I got it somewhere, but it's, I don't know where it is at the moment, I can lay my hands on it, says Mechemet Mitzvah without discussion, as even what goes on in Gaza. These, because these are, you know, these are, essentially, it's Pekuach Nefesh, it's life and death, defending the state of Israel, whichever way you look at it. Who's exempt? Who doesn't go to the war? So listen to this, this is famous. Echad Abon Ebay, the bottom of page 4, Lishivato, someone who's just built a house. Echad Abon Ebay, Beit HaBakar, Beit HaTzim, or he's just built a barn. Beit HaTzrod, some sort of storehouse. You know, he's in the middle of building. Ho'el v'ra'oi l'dira, v'achar Abonet, and something where you could live. Echad Abonet, v'echad Alokea, v'echad Shenitin Lov Matana. Whether you've got the house as an inheritance, or whether you just built it, you don't have to go to war. Oh, Yoresha Rezeh Choseh, you can go back. Avala Bone Beit Beit HaTeven or Beit Shach Sadra, but if you've just built things which are very temporary, like a sukkah essentially, that's not an excuse. Turn over the page, and there's a whole list of other exemptions. I gave one here. Building a house, planting a vineyard, betrothed but not yet married. The last one is interesting. He's afraid to fight. If he is afraid to fight, he doesn't go to war. And the rabbis are perplexed. What do you mean? You're trusting God. Emunah, bitachon. Say the rabbis, you know what? There's also human nature. If someone is going to be, as they say in Yiddish, sittering, shaking in the front, in the battle, in the throes of battle, he is going to affect the morale of the army. And the rabbis say, better that he's not there. And Mishav Yare, someone who is afraid, the rabbis say he's afraid of his sins, whatever it may be. Reality is that, say the rabbis, is not someone who should be in the front line, should be fighting, because he will affect the morale of the people around him. That I find fascinating, because that is so true.
You know that's still applied now? It does. We were in Israel about 10 years
ago. I can believe it does.
And we took a walking tour somewhere in Yerushalayim, I don't remember exactly where. And we had this wonderful guy, tall, strapping, like...
They usually are.
Like, like,
yeah, like, I know.
6'6" or something, I saw him.
He panicked.
He said he couldn't do it. He was very honest.
Yeah.
He said he couldn't do it, and they gave him a tour.
Yeah.
But today there's non-combat units, so you can be a job mech, and you can serve your 3 years, and you're just, and you have that choice.
Which is... Yeah, you do the basic training. You do the basic training, no question about it. If it's a real emergency, but God forbid we ever get into that stage, please. All the above in case of Mulchemet Rishu, Mulchemet Mitzvah, everyone must fight. In other words, the idea of exemptions generally is Mulchemet Rishu. If it's pure Mulchemet Mitzvah, obviously there's gradations on Mulchemet Mitzvah. And if we're in a situation, like we said, where everybody, every last life is in danger, then all of these exemptions don't apply anymore. So it's all relative to the circumstance. You're absolutely right. But that's kind of interesting, that in essence it's about non-obligatory war, where you can always make an excuse. Obligatory, you've almost got to be there, every man, woman, almost man, woman, and child. But the reality there is again understood with certain exemptions which, in practical terms, have to be put in. Right? Like this question of morale of the army. It's a real problem, keeping the morale high.
I didn't know what you were teaching today when I came.
Yes.
But on my way over, I heard the news about, the ISIS.
Right.
And I thought, how appropriate.
It's so appropriate.
And I apologize, I'm going to leave if you went through it too, but
We're nearly done, so hang on another 5 minutes and I think we'll be good.
What about the conscientious?
Now, that's a good question. And again, I guess in the army, see what they do, practically speaking, I went through this, you do what they call psychometry, you do a psychometric test. And that immediately will highlight the problems of someone who either conscientious or whatever, or has sort of certain issues, fear or mental issues, whatever it may be, and the army will not take that person.
They'll
get you into a non-fighting group. They do. They even now they've got units which is beyond belief. I mean that what the Israeli army is doing is for I don't know how the unit is described. Well, first on Nachal Haredi and the whole question of the very religious going into the army. That's a whole separate discussion. But they're working with developmentally challenged young men going into the army, Downs and all the rest of it.
Cyber warfare divisions, or people are just working in computers.
And they're working right. And
they also, I know they found like specific things, like people with a certain type of autism are able to be very focused and do certain tasks that
It's a fantastic thing.
You find the niche.
And it is it's beyond wonderful how, because that gives a purpose to people otherwise will feel disadvantaged because they can't contribute somehow to what goes on in Israel. My biggest complaint against the religious not going to the army is you're taking money for the yeshivot. Hakara Satov, you've got to recognize if they're giving something for you, you've got to be part of the society. The number of parents that I've met from people whose kids went to the army who see the boys during this holiday period standing and smoking on street corners, Yerushalayim, is unforgivable. Yeah. And their Rosh Yeshivas should be taken. They should be jailed. I actually believe the Rosh Yeshivas should be jailed. Absolutely. If they don't tell their boys during the holiday time to go and do something, go and volunteer, go and do something for the hospital. Go. Don't just stand on the corners and battle on it. And they don't realize, because of what goes on, what a bad impression this makes. It is changing. And I think it's changing for the best, but it's a slow process. It's a mindset which really does have to change.
What is the source of that attitude?
Oh, it goes back a long way, and it really is another topic. It's another discussion. But it's almost as if, well, we've got God on our side. It's like, it's the same reason why you can double park in Brooklyn. Because you've got God on your side, so, you know, the police won't tow your car. I'm making a joke out of it, but unfortunately, it's almost true.
No, they don't look. When you get into Lakewood and you get on Route 9,
it's scary, Runa.
As soon as you get there, no one's looking when they cross.
It's very scary, and it's frightening. I don't know what it, there is this layback. I don't know. It's complicated. You really need a good psychologist to come in and explain it. Preferably someone who's trained in Israel.
But what you just said about you know, not serving in the army, for the way other religious people may see it. I have friends in Israel who are completely not religious.
Yes.
And this creates such a wedge and such resentment. It only makes the situation more of a
it makes it correct
because they so resent that correct could die and
correct
nobody else
the to me the greatest thing I got when I was in this unit, we were very low on the totem pole, but the sense of respect from the people who saw religious guys, and we were 6 out of a unit of 30 who were dati, but they saw us there, and so much so, again, this Israeli army, it's all about food, right? Jews, food, you got to eat. So they had a barbecue to celebrate the end of the basic training. So they came up to me and another guy, and they said, where can we get the meat from that everybody will eat? Everyone. And they had to go, we said, well, there's a butcher's place. Those days, it was hard. You had to get to a place in Yerushalayim, which had a special hecher of Lando, who was from Bnei Brak, but you could get it because we were near to Jerusalem. And they got it. And it was the most phenomenal barbecue I've ever had in my life. I mean, I have to say that. And more to the point, it was just that sense that they were overwhelmed by the fact, here are religious guys, and they're from guys. I know, look, they're davening, and they're doing all this stuff. They're religious people. They're here with us, shoulder to shoulder, fighting the enemy. Mm-hmm. And that is you can't buy that. You just got to go and do it.
That's a Kiddush
Hashem. And I'm just glad I was part of that.
In the army today, a lot of the non-religious guys, the environment is, they're there, they have no choice, and they have a different kind of attitude and focus, and it's the Hester units, and they're mixed, who are there ideologically and provide so much of the chizuk.
Incredible.
And like my son, when he was sent to, let's say, on an assignment for a week to do something, and they're all non-religious guys, they wore him down because, you know, listening to how they're talking and their attitude, and, you know, as opposed to being with the Hester guys, where they're not only they're learning and they're
it's
inspired
different.
And they're trying to, like, you know.
There's a tremendous malaise among the
There is.
Even among the educated.
Correct.
Some of them are just not choosing to go to the army after
high school. Yeah, high school, and they get exemptions.
Intelligence units, but not everybody.
Right. Correct. Correct. It's an ongoing problem.
They'd rather leave the country.
And a lot of people leave. They certainly go traveling for a long period of time after the army. It's more to discuss. That's really on a different track to what we're talking about, but it is part of the reality. But I still believe that the army represents, as I said at the bottom in the conclusion, war is permitted under limited conditions, values and laws must be upheld in times of war. And then the final page, the Jew must know when war is appropriate, and peace is the order of the day. The army, in a way, guarantees a potential peace situation. It's a strange paradox. We said Hashem ish milchama, and by definition, God is ish shalom at the same time. Without an army, you're open to all the crazy of the world and the ISIS. You don't have to even go far to name all the Meshugoyim running around the Middle East. And the reality is that army is there, and it is absolutely vital. Do they make mistakes? Yeah. Do they get it wrong? Some of the time, no question, but being there and what they do and the internal way that they literally keep the country in such a positive, in so many positive things that come out of the army, the training and the learning, etc., it's beyond belief. The pasuk we know, Hashem Ozlamo Yitain, Hashem Yivarechet, Amova Shalom, that's the prayer. And I said at the end here, power is there as a deterrent not to fight the people of God. In other words, the fact that we're there, we're powerful, we're not there to become a conquering. That's one of the terrible distortions that the Arab propaganda puts out, as if the Israeli army is there as a colonial, you know, we're conquering it. It's not true. This is our ideal, is to have the power for deterrent, but never to use it. True power, one achieves peace through military power, and this is the total philosophy of the IDF, more or less summed up in one sentence. We hope and pray that one day we'll see the army. You know what? I think there's always going to be room for an army, but hopefully not an army that fights, the way the Israeli army has to do, because they're damn good at it when they have to do it. Should never know. But the reality of it is that, you know, it has so much going for it. It's as I said, all of this comes together, and it really focuses so much of what is Jewish about Eretz Israel. The soldiers sitting on the tank. Tell you one final anecdote, because it happened to my brother-in-law. He was in Lebanon in 82, and they went into a Christian village, his unit, to bring out some Christian fighters there who were against the enemy Israel was protecting them. So this is a typical Israeli army story. My brother-in-law he's a frum guy, and he's sitting on the top of his tank, and he's learning. He's got a safer, and he's on the top of the tank, and who comes and speaks to him? Someone from Time magazine, a reporter. The reporter comes up to him and says, does anyone here speak English? And my brother-in-law sort of waves, and he says, who are you? And he says, who he is, where are you from, London? Oh, the reporter says, I'll be in London next week. Can I do anything for you? So he says, well, you could, you know, speak to my parents, tell them I'm still good. When he thought about it afterwards, he said that was the maddest thing he ever said in his life. Because all you need is a Time reporter calling up someone in London saying, I've just been in Lebanon, and then my mother-in-law would faint. She would not be able to handle that news. The picture, we still have it, of him sitting on the tank was in Time magazine.
Wow.
Unbelievable. Sitting there holding a safer on his tank as they were doing what they had to do. That, again, is the Israeli army. It's a very personal story, but it really sums it up. Shalom Nida, as they say, we should never know. What was the pasuk from Kohelet? I quoted this before. Eight milchama for eight shalom. Let's hope we're in the period eight shalom. We'll get to that final period of shalom. Bezrat Hashem, b'mehera b'yomeinu amen. Next time, if we're talking about Israel, we'll talk a bit about Aliyah, I think, and some of the issues, some of the questions, some of the challenges. Bezrat Hashem, 19th.
Everyone, bring a friend.